Well, let's start. Welcome back. If you're interested in real adventure, there's an ARC rally over in the rotunda. You can't leave here anymore since you're in the room, but it's good that they can be here. Just a current events update. I'm not sure. I suppose some people are monitoring this at their offices. The bill that we passed out on Thursday. Yeah, House File 128 we passed out on Wednesday. It just seems like Thursday. Wednesday. In the Ways and Means Committee yesterday. Thank you. Have to keep some grip of time here. Thanks to the people in the hallway and members of the DFL and others for pointing out some of the issues with that in terms of the math. The intention was to bring forward the spending levels and special session House File 1 and that whole budget balancing thing as ratified by the legislature, which would have been the efforts of the two majorities and the governor. That was not exactly true on those things. We discovered that there was some backfill of emergency TANF in the child support enforcement, actually beyond the amount that was in the general fund, so that was a supplanting. That was taken out. The state-operated services adjustments were in the original unallotment, but not in the final passage, so we brought that down to a zero change. And the other three numbers, I looked at it in a biennial way compared to a one-year way, and so those numbers were adjusted as well. So I think that there were some concerns about that. My interest was not to bring forward our part of our remedy that would be unique to this committee's work and part of my position or the committee's positions, but to bring forward the numbers that are already there. So I think we succeeded in that yesterday. And I also wanted to thank NPR for misquoting me when I said I hadn't gotten any calls about that bill. What I was referring to was the spending levels that were in place since 2010. Obviously, I wouldn't have gotten any calls about a bill that was introduced yesterday. I tried to work with the press, but I got some nasty emails from people who thought, well, how could I be such a jerk? And I could be a jerk. I'm capable of that. But I certainly want to be thoughtful. But I was actually kind of surprised that for those levels of retrenchment that there was no feedback to me over that course of the time, nor to the Commissioner of Human Services office. So that doesn't mean that they didn't matter, but it just means that people didn't choose to bring it to my attention. And that was the point I was trying to make. And so we are going to be faced, and just so what this exercise has brought us, I think, and that in the future of that bill is, it'll be moved out of Ways and Means with our adjustments, and that was appropriate. It'll go to the floor a couple days from now, I suppose, and it'll go to conference, and then that'll go wherever it goes. But I think there's two things that come out of this. One is that these are very real times, and there's going to be some interesting decisions made along the course that will affect a lot of people. It does help actually to react to those in ways that are tangible to both the majority and minority leadership as they go forward, as well as to the departments, because they do track those things. And it may not change anything, but at least that way people will know the impact. So I think I'll leave it at that. We have a quorum yet? Okay. Now we're really in order. Representative Hamilton would love to move the minutes, and I thank you for that. Any question about that or protest from Representative Hamilton? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Just one note from Representative Hamilton. anyway, we have quite another massive area to talk about today. Children and Family Services, and I was just contemplating how the department is going to be doing with bringing forward their budget. And I would predict that they're working on line items at this point in a spreadsheet. They'll be bringing this forward on the 15th of February. We'll be hearing it as soon after as we can do that, just to get the discussion going. And I don't envy them their task. They have less time and much newer faces to work with than we do. And so I think when you see what they put together, you'll understand how the gravity of the situation is going to be. So I've asked Rep. Hayden if he would agree to chair the meeting today. He's on the study group with Rep. Lanning about this topic. And I thought that when I thought about it, I thought that'd be a good choice because he's helps me learn about this area. So with that, I'm going to turn the gavel over to him. And so you have...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We appreciate that. I think that this is an important area that we should study, and I would particularly tell the new members, especially those that haven't worked in this area, I think you're going to find Ms. Sullivan Sutton's testimony and overview really rewarding. It really kind of gets to the meat of the work that they do with children and families, and I think will start to illuminate kind of some of the hard decisions we're going to have to make. So with that being said, if Ms. Sullivan Sutton would like to come down and start her overview, that would be great.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Erin Sullivan Sutton. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Children and Family Services at the department. I have been in this position just over 6 months, so I'm still learning some of the complexities of the programs that I will share with you this afternoon. Our plan is that I will do a broad overview and give you the numbers related to all of the programs within Children and Family Services. We also have a number of program experts in the room should you have more detailed questions that I'm able to respond to. Children and Family Services works with counties, tribes, and community organizations to help low-income families and children achieve economic stability through programs such as the Minnesota Family Investment Program, Diversionary Work Program, Child Support Enforcement, Child Care Assistance, Food Support, Refugee Cash Assistance, and Employment Services. This area of the department is also responsible for the work that we do in Minnesota with respect to child welfare, where we work with counties and tribes to ensure that children who are at risk of abuse and neglect and their families receive services quickly and preferably as close to home as possible. We guide policy on child protective services, out-of-home care, permanency, including adoption of children whose parental rights have been terminated. In Children and Family Services, we also operate three of the department's four major information systems: MAXIS, which determines program eligibility, the PRISM system, which handles our child support area, and the Social Services Information System, which supports county operations in the area of certain social services. In your packet, the first pie chart on page 2 of your handouts shows you that the Children and Family Services area is about 11% of all of the Department of Human Services expenditures. And that's a figure I think that is a surprise to many. Related to that, on page 4 in your packet, this shows you that the Children and Family Services forecasted programs are 8% of the department's general fund forecasted programs, which include group residential housing is 3% of the forecasted programs, general assistance 1%, Minnesota supplemental aid 1%, Minnesota Family Investment Program 2%, and Minnesota Family Investment Program child care 1%. And these are the areas that I will include in my discussion this afternoon. George Hoffman presented detailed information to you on all of the department's forecasted programs earlier, including the cash assistance programs that are administered in my area of the department. And so I will not go through that forecast in detail with you, but I will talk about the programs as we go through the meeting today. On page 4 of your handout is a high-level overview of the personnel, non-personnel, and grant values for current Children and Family Services by funding source. And you will see and page 5 provides a breakdown of CFS divisions by funding source. And as you can see, we have six divisions within Children and Family Services. I know that you have all seen the department's org chart, so I won't go through that in detail, but we did want to share that information and the information related to the number of full-time equivalents that are in this area of the department. I would like to make one correction on the FTE page. In the middle of the page on child support enforcement, we found an error this morning. On the far right side of the column, it shows $93,000 and zero FTE. There should be one FTE there. There's an individual who works on fraternity education that should be reflected there. Pages 6 and 7 of your handout provide brief descriptions of four of the federal block grants that are administered by the Children and Family Services. And the federal block grants are provided by Congress to allow flexibility within a broad range of program areas and identify specific general goals and purposes to meet the needs of individuals in individual states. Some of these require a maintenance of effort or match, and I'll give you more detail on them. The first major block grant I want to talk about is the Temporary Assistance to Needy Families, often known as TANF. Minnesota receives $263 million in the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families block grant, and this funding provides assistance to meet the low-income needs, to meet the needs of low-income families to accomplish of five broad purposes under the federal law. Those five purposes include providing assistance to needy families or families in poverty, ending dependence of needy families by promoting job preparation, work, and marriage, preventing and reducing the incidence of out-of-wedlock pregnancies, and encouraging formation and maintenance of two-parent families. These are the broad goals that the federal government has given us, and you determine the specifics of our program in Minnesota. There is a federal maintenance of effort requirement to the TANF funds of $176 million to $188 million per year based on whether or not we meet our work participation rates. The next major block grant that we administer is the Child Care Development Fund. That was $79.8 million in 2010. And this provides supports for low-income families by providing child care assistance and promoting children's learning through the delivery of quality child care and education and after-school programs. The purpose of these funds are to increase availability, affordability, and high quality of child care services. Here, there is also a maintenance of effort requirement of $48 million per year. The next major block grant that we administer is Title 20. Which is general social services funding. Minnesota receives $29 million per year here. This is to help us provide social services that are best situated to meet the needs of individuals or families that are directed to one or more of the five broad goals. First is achieving or maintaining economic support to prevent, reduce, or eliminate dependency. Achieving or maintaining self-sufficiency, including reduction or prevention of dependency, and preventing or remedying neglect, abuse, or exploitation of children and adults and individuals who are unable to protect themselves. Preventing or reducing the inappropriate use of institutional care by providing for services to individuals in the communities so they can remain at home whenever possible. Or securing referrals or admissions for institutional care when people cannot remain safely and well cared for in their home. There is no federal match for the Title 20 block grant, although in Minnesota we combine that with the Children and Community Services Act funding that I'll talk about in a few minutes. And then the two pots of money are allocated to the counties on a formula basis. In Minnesota, local county property taxes and state aids to counties contribute significantly to the funding of social services. We rely very heavily on property tax dollars in this area. We have a small block grant, the Community Services Block Grant, which is $8.3 million a year, which are funds to community action agencies to focus at local, state, and federal resources to support low-income families and individuals in the community. There is no federal match or maintenance of effort, and I'll talk more about those programs later. But generally speaking, those are directed to community action agencies for serving people in the community, including food shelves. The next,
Ms. Sullivan, we have a question. Representative.
Well, thanks, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to say, Ms. Sullivan, thanks for coming. Back to the Title 20. How much? You said property tax is a lot of that. Do you know how much property tax supports that? And do you know? I mean, maybe just even beyond that topic, it'd be interesting to know how much property tax supports all the things we do in the whole our whole human service budget. So maybe they could get that to us sometime. That'd be a more comprehensive thing. But do you know offhand just what this is?
Representative Abler, Mr. Chairman, we can get that for you. It varies by program. I can tell you, for example, in the area of child welfare, Minnesota is 49th in terms of general fund contribution to child welfare. The state in Minnesota, the state tends to pay for permanency through adoption assistance and relative custody assistance, and a little bit of money in the Community Services Act, but it's probably close to 55% of the child welfare expenses are borne by property tax dollars. But we can get that to you for all of the social services programs through our SEGAR report.
And Mr. Chair?
Representative Baywell.
Ms. Sutton Sullivan. Sullivan. Sorry. Okay. Anyway, I was told that 49th ranking number, and when I had the chat with the nice folks that were talking to me, that's not a helpful statistic to have me, unless I know the comprehensive thing, because we are, as a state, putting money into those by county choices and otherwise, and so especially when we're making the decisions about what we should do, we want to know the total impact and all that. So that'll be helpful. And you have some answers. So thank
Mr.
you.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, Mr. McWhorter. For total social services programs, county expenditures for 2009 were $472,198,636. CCSA dollars were $50,276,000, and Title 20, $32,038,738. We'll get you a copy of this page.
Thank you.
The next several pages.
Ms. Sullivan Sutton. Mm-hmm. Representative McDonald.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Sullivan Sutton, in regards to the property tax, so that was in the title, SSBG, so that was just county property tax, the number that you stated, the $472 million, is that correct?
Yes.
And then what portion in the commercial property tax, which I believe is around 3% for Minnesota commercial property tax, is some of that funds also funding these programs, or is it just county-based?
What's that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I'm not able to answer that question. We can see if we can answer it.
Representative McDonald.
Yeah, thank you. That would be fine. I'm able to get back to me on that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Continue, Ms. Sutton. Representative Hodge.
Mr. Chair, just for some clarification on that, the commercial property tax is a general fund revenue source. So I would assume a portion of that goes to the state portion of the CCSA grants, but I believe the local portion was just the local county share, and the business property tax you're talking about is a state property tax.
Representative McDowell.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. I think it's important to note that these programs that are very beneficial and helpful to children and families, I think it's important that the public know that they come from the very counties, that we in our own counties are able to help those who are in need, more so than the state in large. So I think that's an important note, and I appreciate you bringing that to our attention.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, the next several pages of the handout that you have are at grant tables of our forecast programs and our non-forecast programs. What I plan to do now is go over a high-level overview of these programs for you, and I will refer to the grants tables during the course of this discussion.
Ms. Sutton, we have a question. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have a question about, and I didn't want to go back on where it says major federal block grants and CFS. under TANF. Some of the other ones you mentioned, whether there's a federal match and a maintenance of effort, but under the first one, under TANF, it just says there's no, there is federal maintenance of effort requirement, but I just wanted to clarify, does that mean there is no match?
Miss Sutton.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kiffmeyer, the maintenance of effort requirement is what is required, not a separate match, but it is a maintenance of effort that, that the state needs to fund $176 to $188 million per year.
Yes, but there is no separate match. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sorry. In regards to, whereas in the CCDF one, there is a federal match plus the maintenance of effort.
Ms. Sutton.
Mr. Chairman, yes.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. That clarifies it. Thank you, Ms. Sullivan.
The first area of the programs I'm going to cover is with respect to child safety and permanency. The department administers a number of federal programs to ensure safety, permanence, and well-being for children, youth, and their families, including children who are at risk of maltreatment or in need of protection or services in their families. Last year, there were over 22,000 children reported to counties and two of our tribes who were the subjects of reports of child maltreatment. We also work to serve children in foster care who have goals of reunification with their families, or children who need to achieve permanency through adoption or transfer of custody. In the past 10 years, Minnesota has reduced reliance on out-of-home care by 40%. And so we're able to keep kids safely in their homes whenever possible, or to ensure that they have permanent families. Currently, we have about 11,000 children in out-of-home care. We also work to support youth who are transitioning from foster care to adulthood and independence, and work to serve birth families, foster, adoptive, and relative care families. There are a number of federal programs along with state funding that provide a continuum of services from child abuse and neglect prevention and treatment through adoption and other permanency supports. So the programs that you will likely hear about during the course of the next several months are Title 4E, Foster Care and Adoption Assistance. That provides the federal match for children who are in out-of-home placement if they meet 4E eligibility requirements, or children, special needs children who have been adopted out of the foster care system. There are federal Title 4E Foster Care Independence Funds that provide training for youth transitioning from out-of-home care, as well as some assistance for children pursuing post-secondary education. Now, if you look on page 11 of your grants charts, page 12 of your grants chart, you'll see that the children's services grants are kind of combined into one area there. We also work to support services for family preservation and family support programs from Title 4B of the Social Security Act, as well as a Child Abuse Prevention and Treatment Act, which directs each state to develop a system for responding to reports of alleged maltreatment. Minnesota is one of 12 states in the country that is a state-supervised, county-administered child welfare system. And as I mentioned, we rely very heavily on county property tax dollars. I'm going to go over just very briefly a high-level summary of the work in the area of child safety and permanency. I mentioned the responsibility for working with counties to develop and maintain a child protection system for responding to reports of alleged child maltreatment. In Minnesota, we have significantly reformed our child welfare system in the past 10 years. So that we have a system that is more responsive to the unique needs of families coming to our attention, oftentimes for reasons of poverty and challenges families have meeting the basic needs of their families. That is called Family Assessment Response. In Minnesota, we had a four-year intensive evaluation where we were able to demonstrate that changing the way child welfare responds to families produces better results and keeps children safer sooner. And the state provides a small allocation to all 87 counties, and the counties contribute significantly to that, too. We direct about $2.9 million in federal funds the counties, and they spent about $8.8 million to provide services to families to keep kids safely at home. We also have an early intervention program in Minnesota called the Parent Support Outreach Program, where there's about $800,000 allocated to families to provide early intervention services to families who are reported to Child Protection, but on that particular day, the situation isn't bad enough to get into Child Protection. There again, the counties put about as much county money in to provide early intervention services, and that program is available in 30 counties. And what's been demonstrated is for those counties that have the early intervention services, they see fewer reports of child maltreatment and a reduction in out-of-home placement. And that's one of our challenges, is bringing those programs to scale.
Ms. Sullivan Sutton, we have a question. Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Sullivan, I'm looking at this, the child support enforcement grants, and I know that there's a lot of families out there that are desperately needing this money to come into them. How effective are the grants in making sure that parents, it's not just men, there are women out there too that are obligated to pay child support, that these grants are effective in making sure that these payments get to those families?
And
Mr. Chairman, Representative, if you give me 1 minute, I'll get to child support.
Okay.
Thank you.
Sorry.
In addition to the core child protection activities, as I mentioned, we have responsibility for supporting adolescents who are transferred in out-of-home care. In addition to that, of interest to you would be the work that we do in the area of adoptions. You provide significant funding for the adoption of special needs children from our foster care system. And when courts terminate parental rights, the parental rights of children who are in our system, the system has a responsibility to find permanent adoptive families or relatives who can assume permanent legal responsibility for those children. Currently, there are 7,500 children on adoption assistance, and that is, as I said, funded by the state as well as the federal government in Title IV-E. We have reduced the number of children waiting for adoption by 70% in the last 13 years, but we still are challenged to find families for 348 children, most of which are 12 to 18 years old. And counties and state as well as private agencies are working to find permanent adoptive families for those children. You also provide support for 1,950 children who are living permanently with relatives from the foster care system. And another area I want to mention briefly is the area of Indian child welfare. You provide funding to be allocated to all 11 tribes as well as four urban programs serving Indian communities to help them provide services to prevent the removal of Indian children and to support reunification of Indian children with their families when they do need to be removed. You also have provided $4.7 million in state funds for us to contract with Leech Lake and White Earth bands of Ojibwe who have taken over the child protection responsibility for children and families living on their reservations.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Abel.
Hi. This whole tribal state county interaction, I don't know if it's germane for today's discussion, but maybe at the end you can spend, if we have enough time, you could kind of revert to that and talk about how those work together and how it's working. And I'm trying to get a meeting set up with some of the tribes to see how it is going for them and to see if we can make it better somehow. So maybe we'll just, if there's time at the end, Mr. Chair, we can revert to that topic.
Ms. Sullivan Sutton.
The department also manages a statewide child welfare training system that provides comprehensive training for new social workers that you have required us to do through legislation, as well as experienced social workers, supervisors, and training on the use of the social services information system. We also manage a quality assurance system. Minnesota, like all 50 states, have a federal review of our child welfare system every several years. And we do a similar review in each of our 87 counties and the two tribes who have taken over child welfare. The idea is to focus on performance standards and measures and to make sure that we are achieving the outcomes and goals that we are supposed to achieve. Minnesota, like all of the other states, are under a federal program improvement plan. We're in our first year of implementation, and we hope to successfully complete that in the next couple of years. The final area, the child safety and permanency area, I want to talk very briefly about is the Children and Community Services Act, sometimes known as CCSA. You will see that on page 12 of your handout. The state allocation for CCSA is about $64 million. In 2003, the legislature created a consolidating fund to support an array of social services to children, adolescents, and adults who experience dependency, abuse, neglect, poverty, disabilities, or chronic health conditions, or other factors.
Ms. Sullivan Sutton, can we just, I think you had page 12, but it looks like it's on page 11 of our handout.
Thank you for bringing that to my attention. I'll hit one of your handouts, which looks like our number is different.
Yeah, no, that's okay.
are made to counties on a formula basis, and counties develop a biennial plan in terms of sharing how they will spend those allocations. Under these grants, county agencies have provided services to approximately 350,000 people. These services that counties are focusing on, as I mentioned, are preventing or remedying neglect, abuse, or exploitation of children or adults who are unable to protect themselves, preserving, rehabilitating, or reuniting families, helping people to achieve and maintain self-sufficiency, including reducing or preventing dependency on government programs. Services are provided with respect to serving people with mental health disorders and providing treatment to those individuals and preventing or reducing inappropriate institutional care by providing community-based care or home-based care.
Ms. Sullivan Sutton, we have a question. Representative Godwalk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just real quickly to the testifier, and it may be a topic for another presentation another time, but as I look at these amounts of money and what they're going for, these very good things that we're trying to do this on, how do we, is there a formal process of assessment about whether the dollars are accomplishing what we intend them to accomplish?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Godwalt, in the area of child welfare, we measure and report on counties' ability to achieve the outcomes that they are intended to achieve. And for example, if you go on the department's website, there is a dashboard that you can look at county by county performance. And I would say that the notion of measuring performance is really to encourage continuous improvement in services. Nobody gets it right all of the time, and it really is about working to raise the bar as we move forward. Thank you.
Ms. Sullivan, so now I have a question. In the CCSG grants or program, does it also cover adult protection? It seems like I've heard that before. Is that also a small part of what it does as well for seniors that are vulnerable or vulnerable adults that need that are being abused and need some investigation?
Mr. Chairman, yes. What counties tell us in their biennial plans is that the three areas that they probably spend most of this money is in adult and child protection, as well as mental health. But some counties do it differently just in terms of how they pool their resources and what dollar they allocate to what activity. And adult protection is among them.
Can you give us a sense of what they do in adult protection, just for information's sake?
Mr. Chairman, members, in adult protection, there is a Maltreatment of Vulnerable Adults Act in Minnesota law, the same, similar to the in the children's area, and different entities receive reports of alleged maltreatment of vulnerable adults. It may be physical abuse, it may be neglect, it may be misappropriating or misusing the physical resources an elderly person has available. The Department of Health also works in that area, but they will conduct investigations of those allegations and provide services to those individuals who may need them.
Thank you.
On page 13 of your handout is information over a period of time on relative shares of state, federal, and county spending in children's services. And as we mentioned earlier, there's a significant reliance on county property tax dollars. The second line are the federal resources, and the third line that you have are the trend of state resources. And I should mention that bump in 2008 was a one-time allocation that the legislature provided in anticipation of the loss of federal revenue through child welfare targeted case management that was part of the medical assistance program. That federal loss did not occur, and subsequently you passed legislation to recoup those funds. On page 15 of your...
Ms. Sullivan Sutton, Representative Abel.
Yeah, before you move on, can you go back to page 12, at least our page 12? And the refugee thing, we were just chatting up here. You know, I've been here 12 years now, and we seem to have covered programs for everybody we could think of, and I'm surprised that somehow in that time we didn't come up with a refugee program because we have so many. just surprised that somebody didn't think to do that, and there's $9 million, it's like, in federal money. And there must be, is this just the children's part of refugees that we don't have a program for, or is there federal money and then we just live within that for all the services that they might need?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Abler, these are federal funds that provide services to children and adult refugees. But you are correct, it's only federally funded.
Mr. Representative Abler.
And so the services they get then are made up by nonprofits that would be helping or their neighborhood groups. And so I find that interesting. So it's, thank you.
Yes, they are provided by community agencies that we allocate funds to. On page 13 of your handout is simply, or actually page 14 of your handout is simply an illustrative picture of the change in our state's child welfare system over the past 10 years. You can see the top line is the number of reports, child abuse neglect reports coming into agencies. That has remained fairly consistent over the past 10 years. The line starting at the bottom and increasing is the number of families who are able to participate in the Family Assessment Response Program. Now about 70% of the families who come to Child Protection receive a family assessment, so we're not focusing on finding fault, but rather supporting families to safely care for their children. And then you see a corresponding reduction in the number of what we call forensic investigations, where the focus really was on determining whether parents maltreated their children, and oftentimes was not helpful in terms of the response to those individuals. The next page in your packet is an illustration of the reduction in out-of-home care in Minnesota over the past 10 years. As I mentioned to you, Minnesota has reduced out-of-home care by 40% in the last 10 years. I will tell you that we continue to be challenged with adolescents in placement. We have large numbers of children who come into out-of-home care, oftentimes to access treatment or because of delinquency behaviors in adolescents that show up in these numbers as well.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, recently we passed a bill through this committee that made some cuts in some human service areas, including some that you've just been discussing. And before we took the vote on that, I don't think we had very much discussion or education about exactly what was there and what was being cut. And I also understand that later Representative Abler offered some amendment to that in another committee, and I'd also like to hear a little bit about that, what that was and why that change occurred. But I wonder if you could educate us a little bit, maybe you're not prepared today, but about what was cut and, walking us through now what you've been showing us, what was cut and what the impact or potential impact of that would be, if you could.
Ms. Sullivan said.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I don't have that bill before me. I can tell you my understanding of the bill that you were looking at was a continuation of what had been unallotted by the previous administration. And if you would like more information and analysis, we can certainly provide that for you.
Representative Lehman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, yes, I would. But also there was some discussion about how some of that had been backfilled by some federal stimulus dollars. And I don't think at the time we had much information about exactly where those dollars had been and presumably where they are not now. So if you could get that to us and... you know, unfortunately, I think in the normal course we would have done that before we took that vote, but here we're in the situation of having taken it, and I think it's still important for committee members to know exactly what happened and what the current status of the bill means, since I don't think with its having been amended it's going to come back here to this committee, but I still think we should be educated about that.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Representative, we will give you that information.
Thank you.
Representative Abel.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and for the benefit of Representative Liebling. We started the meeting at 12:37. About 12:39, I did discuss that topic here, and I'll just, for your benefit and those who were not here then either, I think the committee process did work. Bills move through committee, and new information comes, and then you make adjustments based upon what was learned. The intent was exactly as... was said by and echoed by Ms. Sullivan Sutton, was that was actually the enacted levels. That was our intention. In that bill, there were actually some unallotment levels that were not enacted. And so upon review by your comments and others and the hallway, and finally got some research out of the department, and they're very busy, we came to find out that the child protection, the child support grants were indeed backfilled by TANF, actually to an extent beyond the original budget, and so that was merely a supplanting that was done. And so we took that out. We discovered that the state-operated mental health piece was, that was the unallotment number. The enacted number was in the base, and so that was taken out because that was inappropriate. And the CCSA numbers, we looked at those as a biennial function, not as an annual. And so as a result, I chose to adjust all three of those numbers down to reflect the biennial impact of the special session House File 1. So the numbers would be as I said. And so the impacts would be as they were. And I thought that was a fair way to handle it, and I announced that in the beginning of the meeting. And so that was that. So I hope that helps.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Abler. I wasn't criticizing your having changed those numbers. I simply... and I apologize for being late today, but I was simply wanting to know what that was. But, you know, I think it does bring up kind of the point that our usual process here is to learn first and then take action. And I think in this case we took action before learning. And I know that might not have been your choice as the chair of this committee, but I do think that it brings an important point that our process is there for a reason. And when people want to just rush things through, that sometimes... it can create more problems, and I just hope that we can follow a regular process where people can be informed and know what they're voting on before they do take those votes, and then perhaps the chair won't have to scurry around and try to fix things after the fact. But thank you for the explanation.
Mr. Weber.
Well, and just I'll just take that as face value, and I appreciate that, but I think the and just going forward, every omnibus bill has had multiple pages of work to remedy or to correct numbers. The most interesting case in point was, I forget which omnibus it was, required a 99-page amendment to fix it just a couple years ago. So, just interrupting Ms. Sullivan Sutton's time here, but I think that given the task at hand, and I mentioned how little feedback there was from the counties and whoever about the impact of Special Session House File 1, at least to me and to the commissioner's office, that there was none. And so I pointed out that it's good to engage both the majority and the minority in your comments and different departments, because at least they track those things. But as our bill goes forward, we're going to have a 500-page amendment someday in this committee. There'll be a process. We'll hear the bulk of those things, at least in mention. There'll be some language nobody ever saw before. That's just how it works out. That's a bipartisan method of doing it. Hopefully not too many novel ideas. And there'll be feedback about that. And I hope that for my sake of how we I'm managing to a bill enacted, and so policy vets some of the major policy things, some of the smaller policy things, and other stuff will come through here. That's also our custom, and then it'll go off to taxes or ways and means or some other stop, certainly ways and means, and then to the floor. And some of the fixes we seek will not be made until conference. And that's and hopefully at the end the governor can sign our work if it's done that well. If it's too far off, then he would be disinclined. So I don't think anybody should ever quit discussing any bill that we're working on here. And that's just meant to be a positive, proactive answer. And we are, the department, I mentioned earlier, I'll just repeat what I said about the department bill that's going to come out in 2.5 weeks or a few weeks. They're going to have very limited time to put a bill together. And I don't envy our new good commissioner her role in shepherding that thing through the target they're going to have to hit to achieve the Governor Dayton's budget. And so I don't think we'll spend a lot of time saying some of those choices are not the ones we would have made. Maybe we will. I don't know. It depends what how the day is going. But they're putting a budget together in short order, and we'll react to that how we do. But we also understand the reality of their time and what they could put together. And so we're going to help find ways that will, you know, work on, build on those and in better ways. So I don't mean to ramble about that. But we've got a heck of a job on our hands. The governor does. The department does. And at the end, I hope we keep in mind the targets of our work. And I think this discussion is very productive in this topic today. And I thank Representative Liebling for raising the point again so I could repeat those comments. Thank you.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Sutton, Sullivan Sutton, just a question. This is a learning experience, so I appreciate Representative Abling's mentioning of learning. We certainly will learn. Question for you, is it possible for individuals and families to be eligible for several of these programs concurrently, the MFIP, the WP, the MFIP, and so on and so forth?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I'm just about ready to move on, and I will answer that question because in some programs, yes, but not in others, and I will explain that as we talk about the economic assistance programs.
If you could, and then also Representative Franzen has her question. She would like, if you hadn't gotten to that, she'd like that answered as well regarding the child enforcement payment. What was the question?
Representative.
Something that.
Representative McDonald.
So just to, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. That's good. A perfect segue.
We have one more question. Okay. Well, no, thank you. Continue, Ms. Sullivan. Okay.
Next, I want to talk about the work that we do in the child support area, and that is referenced on page 11 of your grants table. In order to receive the federal temporary assistance for needy families block grant that I mentioned, that funds our Minnesota Family Investment Program and other Minnesota public assistance programs, the state is required to operate a child support program, which needs to be in compliance with federal state plan amendments. Federal law requires that all child support enforcement services be available to all children who receive public assistance and to any individual who files an application for services with the child support agency. The work that we do in child support covers a number of areas. We work to establish paternity for children. About 174,000 children who have a Minnesota child support order were born outside of marriage. And as of September 2010, paternity was established for all of those children. We work to establish child support orders, including orders for medical support, locate parents, their income and assets. And I should say, this, like other programs, we operationalize through our county systems, our county agencies. The counties collect, and we in the counties collect and disperse child support collections. In 2009, there was $620 million in collections. It was a slight decrease down to a $606 million in 2010. Child support orders are enforced through a variety of mandated enforcement remedies, including data matches with respect to our financial institutions, income withholding, suspension of licenses, and the like. We also, as I mentioned, operate a case management computer system to support the delivery of child support services. As I said, most but not all child support case activities are performed at the county level. However, the department itself has some specific responsibilities. I mentioned managing the PRISM automated system. We also manage the state disbursement unit. We have responsibility for program development and interpretation of policy, as well as providing training and technical assistance to county offices, including county attorneys. We have a customer service hotline where we receive almost 63,000 calls a month, and individuals access our web services about 175,000 times a month. So there's a lot of direct interaction, and we, like in other areas, monitor program performance with federal requirements, and as I said, we provide technical assistance and guidance to counties as well as tribal agencies. We have two tribes in Minnesota, Red Lake and White Earth, that have responsibility for operations of child support on their reservations. I'm going to give you a little bit of data about the scope of our child support. We serve 256,000 children and 396 parents annually. We have had seen some changes in the caseload trend in the last 3 years, from 2007 to 2010. We've actually seen a 1% decrease in the caseload size. The number of individuals who've never been on public assistance but avail themselves of child support services have risen by 10.4%. The number of individuals who formerly were on public assistance cases have actually decreased by 12.5%, and current public assistance cases we've seen a decrease in 2.5%. There has been a steady increase in collections from 2000 until 2009, and I mentioned a slight dip in 2006. In terms of the program funding, county dollars pay about $30 million, or 18% of the child support expenditures. The state funds $13.5 million, or 8% of expenditures. And the federal government has the largest share here, about $121 million, or 73% of the expenditures in the child support area.
Ms. Sullivan Sutton, I think it would be helpful to, I mean, you've done a good job in talking about where the money, how the money is used. That money is directly to the staff that goes out and that establishes paternity, collects the money, gives the advice, etc. Right? That money doesn't pass through to the actual custodial parent, right?
Madam Chair, I may need some assistance here. There are administrative expenditures that pay for the people who do the work.
Right.
The collections of child support coming through child support orders go back to the families who are caring for the children. Waylon Campbell, who's the Director of Child Support, can add to that.
Mr. Campbell, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Waylon Campbell. I'm the Director of the Child Support Enforcement Division in DHS. As Assistant Commissioner Sullivan Sutton mentioned, our collections are passed on to parents. The money I think that is indicated on page 11, the $3.355 million, that is paid out to counties to help them fund their administrative costs. And it's paid out on a performance basis where if they make a collection, they get, or if they make establish an order, they get $100. If they establish paternity, they get $100. If they modify an order, I think they get $100. And some money is paid out based on the percentage of collections with public assistance. But it's entirely based on performance. But you're right in that money does not go directly to parents.
Mr. Campbell, the money, so if there is a parent or a family that is on the Minnesota Family Investment Program, and you go out and collect the money from the non-custodial parent, where does that money go?
Mr. Chair and members, that money is sent to the custodial parent, even though that parent is on MFIP, but that money is budgeted against the MFIP grant.
So, Mr. Campbell, every dollar that they receive, they would get less than the money that we would give them for cash assistance in the MFIP grant. Is that right?
I believe that it's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Franzen, did that help you with your question, or did you get an answer?
No, that does, yep.
Okay. Thank you. Ms. Sullivan Sutton.
Oh, wait.
Tim Francis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and it's Mr. Campbell. You also charge the those who receive the child support like a 1% fee also, correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Franzen, that's correct.
And so where does that fee, what does that fund?
Mr. Chair, Representative Franzen.
Mr. Campbell.
That fee is split. The federal share of the fee, which is about two-thirds, we have to return to the federal government. The remaining third is given to counties, and it's paid out roughly in the same way we pay out the other performance incentives. It's added to the pot.
Representative France.
So I understand that, but in my opinion, this is just a statement. It seems like those families that are really needing the money to survive to raise their children are kind of being punished because we're accepting money from the federal government. That's just my opinion.
Thank you, Representative Franzen. Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Campbell, on the person who's receiving the MFIP amount of money per month, how much is that? Is that the $280 a month amount, or are you...
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I will get to the MFIP program in a moment, but I can tell you that the benefit level for MFIP for a family of three is $532, and that has not changed since 1986. So the benefit levels have remained the same for 24 years.
Representative
Fritz.
Since 1986?
That's correct.
That has not been changed. All right, thank you. That answers my question.
Ms. Sullivan, Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And would that same family be eligible for any other programs in addition to the one that you just explained? And I have a follow-up as well.
Ms. Sullivan, sir.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that family, yes, could be eligible for other assistance. They may be eligible for food support, which I'll talk about. They may be eligible for child care to help them pay for care so that the parents can get to work or to go to school in order to get employment. They also may be eligible to receive mental health or chemical health services as well.
Representative Hamilton.
And Mr. Chairman, and thank you. First of all, thank you for all that you do as well. What would be extremely beneficial, Mr. Chairman, is if we had a spreadsheet that would list out every program and dollar amount available, whether it's for every scenario, whether it's a single male, whatever, or whether it's a family, and just keep it very simple to where a person can look at that and say, all right, this is all the programs available, and these are the dollar amounts, and you can add those up on a monthly basis as well. I think that would be helpful.
Ms. Sullivan.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we will see what we can do. As you can tell from my comments today, we operate some very complex programs in this area, and there are very different scenarios depending on the individual's particular circumstances. Some of that you will see more in my testimony yet to come, but we will see if we can at least do some illustrations for you.
Right. And
Representative Hamilton.
And this will be the last one, Mr. Chair. And I think by having that information, for those of us at least that serve on the committee, then we would be able to explain it to colleagues and constituents and everything else, because I think there's a lot of anecdotal stuff out there as well, and maybe there does need to be some fundamental changes to the programs, but if we had that information, it'd be extremely helpful.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to follow up on what Representative Hamilton was saying. I was thinking along the same lines. What I think would be helpful is if we had a matrix that showed what kinds of assistance is available and what the eligibility requirements are, and whether those requirements are federally imposed or discretionary at the state level. All of this information is very, very helpful, but it doesn't give us what we need in terms of who's eligible to receive what. And I think we need a matrix like that, and I'd be happy to work, and since Representative Hayden and I will be charged with doing some follow-up on that, we can work together in trying to get that put in the form that is more understandable by all of us.
Well, we have a couple more questions, but I think to that fact, Representative Lanning and others, I think part of it is the amount or the programs that people are eligible for and how they become eligible for that. But I think what else would be helpful is what do they have to do? Because there are requirements that folks that get on these programs have to do, and I think that that is another one of those misnomers that people don't have to do anything in order to get them. There are very strict requirements in terms of the how you participate and the things that you have to do and how many hours you have to look for work, et cetera, to be eligible for those the benefits, period, much less the extra benefits like child care and others that they would get. So I think working with Representative Lanning to kind of lay that out in a way, hopefully, that members can get a snapshot view of what those families would look like would be important.
That's right.
Representative Hamilton, and then we have two other questions.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You're absolutely right. I mean, the more that we're informed, you know, the better prepared we are to answer these questions or to answer questions as they're presented to us, but also to form our questions as well.
Yes,
so
sir.
We're more educated in the process. And the same thing goes, Mr. Chairman, for the services for people with disabilities and right on down
absolutely.
The list.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to piggyback on this, I would encourage, most of this information is all available online. For example, the Family Self-Efficiency and Healthcare Program Statistics. It comes out quarterly. It's the forecast from DHS. Shows historical data. And for example, in our welfare programs, whether it's TANF, MFIP, or the old AFDC program, in 1992, we spent $145 million in that. Today, in 2009, we spent $54 million. And that same report shows that the caseload went down from 190,000 down to 98,000. And this historical data is readily available right at our fingertips. DHS does a really good job on forecasting, and this information is all transmitted from the counties to DHS. And I think it's, and especially in areas of self-efficiency and economic assistance programs, I think the numbers would surprise most people.
Thank you, Representative House. Representative Anderson.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I have a question. Under the Child Support Collection Division, how many? Do you know what the percentage of the people on that program are non-welfare people, people not receiving TANF grants or MFIP grants, and how many are receiving?
Ms. Sullivan, or Mr. Campbell, I guess we'll let you get some exercise today.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, your question was how many individuals are on our program that are not receiving public assistance? We have that figure, but we don't have it here. If we can get it for the committee.
Okay, if you could get it for me, that would be great.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Campbell.
What we can show you is on the chart on page 11 is that $10.5 million was collected and distributed to families receiving MFIP benefits, and then above that is the total amount collected in that year.
Representative Slava.
I just want to make just a quick point, and then Mr. Campbell, I mean, there are people that ask the county to collect their child support, and they do pay a fee. Is that not correct?
Mr. Campbell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Slava, that's correct.
What is the fee? Mr. Campbell, Mr. Chair.
There are several fees. There is a cost recovery fee of 1% that is that was instituted by the state. There is also a $25 annual fee that the federal government requires, and that's a one-time fee after
$500 that's collected, the next $25 goes for the fee. And there's also an application fee of $25.
Representative Flo.
Mr. Chair, so just to say, you might want to include that information too, because there are people that have can't get the child support and they're not on MFIP, so they pay all kinds of fees, 1% of what they would be getting, to have this, the counties do it, or state. But if you could, can you, when you're putting things together, if you could include that, I'd appreciate it. That's okay. So you can see the fee structure, too, of what we charge people.
Oh, yeah, I know about the fees.
Ms. Campbell, I have one more question. Is that 1% for both participants that are on public assistance and those that aren't, or is that, does that only apply to those that are not on public assistance?
Mr. Chair, that applies only to people who are not on public assistance, and it only applies to those who were at one time on public assistance, but after they've been on off public assistance for 2 years.
Thank you, Mr. Campbell.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, members, I will move along to talk about child care. In the child care area, I'll refer you to page 10 of the grants page. There are actually two components of the child care program that we administer. One is the child care assistance program, and the second is child development services. The child care assistance program is funded through a mixture of federal funds, the child care development fund that I mentioned earlier, as well as the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families Fund and the State General Fund Appropriation. The Child Care Development Fund is a federal program that supports low-income working families through child care financial assistance and promotes children's learning by improving the quality of early care and education and after-school programs. And you will see we...
Ms. Sullivan Sutton, if we can take just a moment, it doesn't look like we're lining up again. So I think you're reading from, what is, page 10 for us?
Yes.
Does that look right?
Yeah, at the bottom of page 10 is the summary, and I'm giving you some additional information.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure everybody knew where we were.
Page 10 is the child care development.
Ms. Sullivan Sutton.
And then basic sliding fee is right above that in the middle of the page. State law addresses the purpose and implementation of the child care assistance program and the child care resource and referral system, the early childhood and school age professional development system, and other supports for improving the quality of child care. We are particularly focused on improving the quality of child care for high risk children and connecting that to the child's preparedness to enter school at kindergarten. The federal and state funding for child care programs was $231 million in federal fiscal year 2010, and that included $215 million for a child care assistance program and $11.6 million for child care quality. There were significant changes in to reduce the growth in the child care assistance program that occurred in 2003. And in the 04 and 05 biennium, there was a reduction in state appropriations of $86 million. Within the child care assistance program, there's the MFIP transition year program that pays for child care so that parents may pursue employment or education leading to employment so that their children have access to high-quality child care. And this is available for families who are receiving the Minnesota Family Investment Program or who have recently transitioned off of the Minnesota Family Investment Program. We also have a basic sliding fee program, which is a capped allocation to provide child care subsidies for families that are under 175% of the federal poverty guidelines at program entry. Counties maintain waiting lists when they cannot fund all of the eligible people who would otherwise be able to receive child care assistance. Families may continue to receive child care assistance until they reach 250% of the federal poverty guidelines. Families do have co-pays, which will vary based on their income. On average, there were 19,000 families receiving child care assistance in 2010, and the average monthly payment was $903. 49% are on Minnesota Family Investment Child Care, which includes families receiving either Minnesota Family Investment Program Services or Diversionary Work Program Services. who are moving off of cash assistance, and I'll talk about those two programs in a moment. I also mentioned that we have responsibility for child development services, which provides supports to improve the quality and help parents access information about child care. In the last year, there were 27,000 referrals for parents for child care providers. We work to increase the quality of early care and education and school-age child care through grants and financial supports for providers. And we also are in the initial stages of a pilot quality rating and improvement system that Representative Slawick has been working on, and that pilot is scheduled to end in June of 2011. We provide families and communities with information to support their children's success and access to quality child care through a network of child care resource and referral programs throughout the state. We also work to support a growing a competent, skilled early childhood and school-age care workforce through the provision of training, mentoring, and coaching on child development and instructional practices, and the dissemination of information. There are a number of challenges in this area, including the size of caseloads and program complexity, as well as bringing successful pilots to scale like we've seen in other areas. With that, I want to turn to work supports.
Ms. Sullivan, I just have a quick question. So you mentioned co-pays, that families that take advantage of this have a co-pay. Can you talk a little more about where those dollars go, who has to pay them? Are they paid to the provider, or are they paid to the county, or how does that relationship work?
Mr. Chairman, members, when a person has responsibility for a co-pay, they pay the co-payment directly to the provider, and then that is supplemented with the child care assistance that's available to them.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Franz?
Just a statement, Mr. Chairman. Yes, as a daycare provider, I would receive payments from the subsidy program. And so if their co-payment was $81, I would add up the rest of their days and then subtract the $81 from that bill, and the county would pay the rest.
Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Representative Flaw.
Well, Mr. Chair, Ms. Sullivan-Sutman, can you explain, we passed legislation about having scholarships to supplement the co-pays because some parents couldn't make the co-pays, so we also allow other nonprofits to make the co-pays, right? I just think if members should know that sometimes the co-pays are still difficult for the parents, so there is a legislation allowing Lutheran Social Services, Catholic Social Services, and places like that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Slawick, that is correct. And Sherry Telnick is here if you'd like more information on that.
Welcome to the committee, and can you give us your name for the tape?
My name is Sherry Telnick, and I manage the Child Care Assistance Program, and Representative Slawick is correct. There was a year when we discovered that co-payments were quite high and parents were having trouble accessing services. We discovered this through the providers, and while the federal government doesn't allow us to waive co-payments for families below poverty level, we did check in with the federal government and passed legislation that would allow third-party co-pays in certain instances if the providers keep track of where they get the money and who they're paying it for.
Representative Abel.
Well, and while you're still here, Ms. Katelnik, welcome to the committee. If the people don't make their co-payment for some reason and the provider would lose the money, does anybody follow up on that, or do they just absorb that and nobody cares?
See
a hand waving.
The child care assistance law has a provision that requires us to terminate assistance if the provider tells us that the parent is not keeping up with their co-payments.
Representative Friends.
Yes, that is true. And as a provider, we also have that option to waive the co-payments if we feel that the family desperately needs the care. And as a provider, I would feel more for the family than I did about the $81. And so sometimes I would just waive that fee as well.
Thank you. Ms. Sullivan.
Mr. Chairman, members, now I'm going to turn to work support programs. And you will see those referenced on page 8. In your handout. I'm going to talk about programs, the Minnesota Family Investment Program, the Diversionary Work Program, and the Work Benefit Program. And these are three programs funded under the Federal Temporary Assistance for Families block grant that I mentioned earlier. All three programs are administered by County Human Service Agency, most of whom contract with the workforce centers for nonprofit agencies to provide employment services. We also have one tribe that currently administers the TANF program. The Minnesota Family Investment Program provides assistance to low-income families with one or more children under the age of 18 or age 19 if the child is in school, and to women who are pregnant. MFIP assistance includes job counseling, cash, food, and child care assistance. Most families are off of assistance within 2 years. The maximum amount of time anyone can be on assistance is 60 months with some very limited exceptions. The Minnesota Family Investment Program provides cash and food benefits for families with children with income up to 115% of federal poverty guidelines. The cash grants are funded with a mixture of the federal block grant and state general fund expenditures, and the general fund expenditures are partly determined by the maintenance of effort requirements that we need to comply with. In 2010, the average number of cases per month was 35,871. There was an annual payment of $312 million for the MFIP program, which included $163 million in food support. The Diversionary Work Program is a work-focused cash assistance program to help families avoid longer-term assistance. These generally are families who are who need some help in on a short-term basis to help them find employment. These services focus on the family's strengths and really work to help them find employment as quickly as possible. The Diversionary Work Program grants are available for 4 months, and it does not count towards the 60-month lifetime limit that families have. There's $17.2 million, the federal block grant that is devoted to the Diversionary Work Program, and a small state share of $828,000 directed to families. Again, these are really services directed at people who are able to obtain employment more quickly than some other people on MFIP program may be. We also have a work benefit program that provides a small amount of money, $25 per month, for families who are exiting the Minnesota Family Investment Program, and they are meeting work requirements for up to 24 consecutive months after exiting the MFIP cash and food portions or the Diversionary Work Program. The work benefit program hours for one-parent households are used by Minnesota to help us meet our work participation rates to be in compliance with the federal requirements. And it's fiscal year 2010, there were 656 cases on average monthly, and there were $500,000 in this program, all state funded. And this program is still being phased in Minnesota, and by 2012, we expect that there will be about 31 cases at an estimated cost of over $1 million to the state. In all, 44,700 families use one of these three programs in an average month. The average monthly payment is $655, and the average federal food portion for MFIP families is about $378 per month. As I mentioned, the benefit levels in the MFIP program have remained constant since 1986. The typical family who's on the Diversionary Work Program or the MFIP program is a single parent caring for two children. White adults make up about 40% of the population, and African American adults or black adults make up 37% of the MFIP population, American Indians 9%, and Asian 6%, and Hispanic 5%. Like some other areas, we are challenged with disparities with respect to families who are served on this program. It is more challenging for black and American Indian participants to have greater challenges and difficulty finding unsubsidized employment, and that's an area we continue to focus on. I should also mention that of all of the MFIP cases, over 50% of the families started with an adolescent birth, and that's an area of concern. Also, 44% of the caregivers on our programs were diagnosed with a serious mental health condition in the past 3 years.
Ms. Sullivan-Sutton, we have a question. Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To the testifier, on the MFIP piece where they are, where folks are receiving benefits, say $1,033 a month with the MFIP and the food assistance, and then they are looking for work, how many hours a week are they required to work, to look for work?
Looks like we're going to have the, some department folks to come in. Ms. DeLage, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Can you give your name for the tape?
My name is Jane DeLage, and I work on policy for the cash assistance programs. The work hours vary depending on the age of the youngest child and whether it's a single or a two-parent family. But the if you have a child under six, then you are required to work an average of 20 hours per week. If you have, if your youngest child is over six, it's 35 hours. Now, when we say work, there's work activities that include some other activities to prepare folks for work. So it's not just unsubsidized or subsidized work, but they're required to meet a certain number of hours of participation. And those are federally prescribed hours and activities.
Representative Fritz.
And a follow-up. Now, of those 30, if you have a child over 6 years of age and you are looking for work, of those 35 hours, are those hours, could those hours be attributed to a junior college or a work program in a community college working towards, say, a nursing assistant license or some other avenue of work? Would they count, those hours count?
Yes, we can count hours of education. However, there is a federal limit on the amount of people who are in our work participation rate who can be in education. That's a 30% limit. So we do have some requirements in statute about who can be in an education program, and they have to meet those requirements as well. So,
thank you.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just, you know, it's so striking that the cash assistance has not increased in 25 years, right? 25 years, people don't get one more dollar than they did 25 years ago, right? But there must be some growth in something else. I mean, I assume that the food support has grown. I mean, can it really be true that people are not getting more than they got 25 years ago?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it is true that the food portion of the grant has continued to grow. And so the food portion, as the food for people who are not on assistance, has gone up based on cost of living requirements. So it becomes an increasingly large portion of the money that the families get, which, of course, doesn't address the increases in rent and other costs that the family has, because the food money can only be used for food.
Representative Lieber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so I don't know if you would have calculated this, but if somebody is, say, a family with a parent and two children is on MFIP and getting maximum MFIP benefits, food support, cash assistance, where do they fall on the poverty level scale? Are they over poverty when they're getting those benefits?
Mr. Lynch.
Representatives, the exit level for MFIP is 115% of the federal poverty guidelines. By the time you reach that exit level, you're no longer receiving any cash assistance. You're only receiving the food portion of the grant. So the grants decrease as your income increases, though you are somewhat better off because of the disregard. You're somewhat better off if you're working than if you're not. But it's not a very high level at which their benefits cease.
Representative Hodge.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a quick question. How much state dollars go to the food portion, the portion that's increased?
Ms. DeLage.
Well, the food portion is a federally funded program.
Representative Zero.
Yes, Representative Zero is correct. There's a very, very small state-funded program.
Ms. Sullivan Sutton.
Okay, just two more points I want to make on the work programs. There are two performance measures that we use to evaluate all three of these programs that are directed by the federal government. One is the work participation rate that Ms. DeLage mentioned, which is a federally mandated measurement of the percent of participants who are engaged in a set of federally approved activities, such as job search and work, for the designated number of hours per week. And there are federal penalties for not meeting the work participation rate. The estimated rate for 2010 is 40%. There's also a self-support index, is a percentage of the program participants who are off cash assistance or working 30 or more hours per week. And this is a state-developed measure that we use to measure our performance, and that counties are able to measure their performance as well. Most counties meet that rate, and the overall self-support index is 67%. And with that, I will move to talk a little bit about the food support program.
We have one question before you make the Ms. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Sullivan Sutton, I want to thank you for your program and your presentation. And I have a question, and I'll preface it by restating your mission, that of providing assistance to needy families, end of dependence of needy families by promoting job preparation and work and marriage, very noble, preventing and reducing the incidences of out-of-wedlock pregnancies, and encourage formation and maintenance of two-parent families, very noble and very important in our society. We know that's the fundamentals of a healthy community. So with that, these temporary programs are meant to encourage that and support and build up great families. What rate of return of investment, and you hate to talk about children and families and returning an investment, but I think it's important for the taxpayers to know that both federally, county, and state, that we're able to help them. But with your temporary programs, it brings them out of poverty, hopefully, and gives them job preparation to be healthy in their communities. So do you have any evidence or proof that of the rate of return on our great investment for our families and businesses?
Ms. Sullivan Sutton, before you answer that, we have about 13 minutes left, so if you can be succinct, and then we want to make sure you get all of your information out. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I think I would go back and mention that most families exit these programs within 2 years, and that is evidence that they are able to obtain and maintain employment. The economic times, of course, are challenging because oftentimes the last hired are the first laid off. And if you'd like more information, we can get that back to you at a later date.
Briefly, Mr. Chairman. So just to repeat, because it's important, it's a 5-year cap, but you're saying most families accomplish this mission and goal within 2 years.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that's correct. They're off the program in 2 years.
And you see, seldom do you see a case that they need to come back. Mr. Chairman. Seldom do you see a case that they come back for assistance.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we occasionally do see cases that come back. We can look to get what data we have on that for you.
Well, that's terrific. That's great, great information. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Haas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is the last time I'm going to talk, but I would encourage the committee to take a look at the Minnesota Family Investment Program report. It's a longitudinal study that directly gets the results of the program. The conclusions is that employment was increased, there is a decline in welfare use, and there is a reduction in the poverty rate. And that's one of the things we need to talk about when it comes to the Minnesota Family Investment Program, is not just the expenditures we have, but the outcomes and the goals that we create. And we do know some things that work. And we actually had a pilot program well before, I think it was in 1998, the Minnesota Family Investment Pilot Program, that was even more effective. But due to budget constraints, some of those outcomes have been reduced. But we know the results. The studies are there. And I would encourage the committee to look at that, too.
Ms. Sullivan Sutton, if you would, to Representative Hosh's point, I think it would be really important for members of this committee, but frankly, members of this body, to get some of that information, if you can get it out, and even point people to the website and links that will help members not just new members, and we always kind of pick on new members, but there are a lot of members that have been here a long time that have forgotten some of those great outcomes. So I think it would be extremely helpful as we start to deliberate these programs if you could get that to us.
Mr. Chairman, we would be happy to do that. And in the remaining 11 minutes, I'll try to talk very fast. I want to move quickly to food support. The Federal Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program is the food support program formerly known as food stamps that is administered by the Federal Department of Agriculture, as was mentioned. That's 100% federal funds. The benefits are issued through electronic means through the EBT card that you may have heard of. Food support benefits in Minnesota total $592 million in state fiscal year 2010. I should mention that the caseload has grown by over 70,000 cases in the past 2 years. We now have over 200,000 cases per month in Minnesota that are on food support, and this is cyclical with our economic trends as well. Benefit levels are based on family income and are determined by the federal government. The average monthly benefit is $260,000 monthly. I should also mention that the Department of Agriculture will tell us that they expect the food support benefits to only help families for about 3 weeks out of a month. So it is known that this is not providing for all of the assistance that they have. The average, about 49% of the recipients were children under age 18, and 40% of the household were families with minor children. We also have adult households on food support, elderly, disabled, and able-bodied adults as well. I mentioned very briefly we have some community action grants. That's a federal block grant. Those funds are combined with many other funds and for services that are offered through our community action programs throughout Minnesota. It's a statewide network of nonprofit programs and also programs offered by our tribal governments. The community action agencies work locally to address local needs and establish local priorities and determine ways to respond to issues of poverty locally. The services that they provide include Head Start, energy assistance, weatherization programs, emergency services, homeless services, nutrition, and programs to seniors. We have a small program called the Family Assessments for Independence for Minnesota that helps low-income individuals save money to help them start businesses or buy homes. But we, through the action agencies, also are responsible for administering the food support program, the food shelf programs. That's on page 12 of your packets. We do food support outreach, and also we distribute the emergency food assistance program, which is provided by the Department of Agriculture, in which they donate food to individuals and families who use on-site meal programs and commodities to our food shelves. The food shelves provide food support to low-income individuals and families who have exhausted other resources, including their food support benefits. We work with Hunger Solutions of Minnesota to allocate commodities across the state based on the population. We also operate a couple of small state and federal grants to help with serving people who are in shelters and transitional housing programs or runaway and homeless youth that comes through our Office of Economic Opportunity as well. We also operate a number of income support programs for single adults without children. There's three I want to mention: the Federal Assistance Program, the Minnesota Supplemental Aid Program, and Group Residential Housing. And if you look on your chart on page 9, you will see those programs. These are services and supports to individuals and couples without children who cannot support themselves, usually due to some sort of disability. The General Assistance Program is a safety net for single adults and childless married couples who are not able to work. The program provides monthly cash support for people whose income and resources are less than the program limits. Participants are also eligible for help with medical costs through general assistance, medical care, or medical assistance programs. The benefit level is $203 a month. They must meet criteria for eligibility. They cannot have income higher than $203 a month, nor can they have assets of more than $1,000. If the person applying for general assistance has a long-term disability, they must apply for other benefits such as SSI, and then they sign an agreement which allows the state to recoup any SSI benefits that they might have been eligible for. We also have a general assistance program for people in residential facilities that provides $89 per month to help meet the personal needs of those individuals in the facilities. Minnesota Supplemental Aid Program is a state fund program which provides monthly cash supplements to people who are aged, blind, or disabled and who receive Supplemental Security Income Benefits, or SSI. This program also allows for special needs payments for program participants for medically prescribed diets that was mentioned earlier. We also may be paying for representative payee services, services for guardians or conservators, or necessary non-recurring home repairs for the individual. MSSA for people in the community is $81 a month. As I mentioned, the individual must be aged, blind, or disabled. Clients must verify income and assets. They cannot have income of more than $735 or assets of more than $2,000 for SSI. There's MSA Shelter Needy, which provides $955 a month of assistance for shelter plus food support. And these are individuals who are on SSI and relocated from an institution or receiving a personal care attendant, and they are able to live independently in the community if assistance is provided. We also have the Group Residential Housing Program, which is also referred to on page 9 of your handout. This is a state-funded income supplement program that pays for room and board costs for elderly or low-income adults with disabilities who are living in licensed or registered community-based settings. The group residential housing rate is $846 a month. The individual must be on SSI or receiving general assistance. Here, too, the individual must be age, blind, or over 18 and disabled. The physical setting that the individual lives in, there must be an agreement with the county, and the setting must agree to accept the group residential housing rate in order to receive that. Clients who are in a congregate settings where food support is provided would not receive other food support benefits. I should mention that there is a moratorium on the development of group residential housing, board and lodging with special services, and there has been a rate reduction by the last legislature in this program area as well. There's also an emergency general assistance and emergency Minnesota supplemental assistance program, which is special once a year funding for emergency situations when a person lacks basic need items such as shelter or food, and the lack of that threatens the person's health or safety. It's a capped appropriation of $9 million a year. The emergency EGA, emergency general assistance, is $7.9 million, and the emergency supplemental assistance is $1.1 million. Last but not least, is the important work that we do in the area of program and assessment and integrity, where we work to avoid overpayments or inappropriate payments for all of our economic assistance programs. Program assessment and integrity is a division that works to do a number of case reviews in child support, TANF, as well as other programs to make sure that only people who are eligible for services actually receive those benefits, and they also have responsibility for fraud and working with counties. In 2010, this area of the department collected over $9 million in overpayments, and that work continues to be very important. I should mention that this is one area of Children and Family Services that is heavily reliant on general fund expenditures to do the work, but it's a very important area in terms of being able to stay on top of those programs. I also mentioned very quickly that we operate three of the major information systems. We operate MAXIS, which is the eligibility system for our cash assistance and health care programs. I think you've heard about the MAXIS system from Tom Baden, who talked to you about the architecture work that's going on in the department. The MAXIS system also has two components related to the child care system. We have the Minnesota Electronic Child Care System, which is known as MEC squared, as well as the Minnesota Electronic Child Care Pro, which is gives the capacity for child care providers to submit their bills electronically and to check on the status of their billings. It's fully integrated with the MAXIS system. We also operate the PRISM system that I mentioned, which is responsible for all of the work that we do in child support, and then the social services information system, which started as this child welfare information system, but has since been expanded to allow counties to use that case management system for adult services as well as other services, and they do their billings through that system as well. I think what I would leave with you is the need for investment and attention to modernizing the systems that we have, particularly the MAXIS eligibility system. As you may know, that's a significant pressure for us, and that is the techie people will say it's on a green screen, and we don't have people who are any longer trained in that system, and it's very important that we work to modernize those systems. And with that, I will conclude. Unless
it looks like that is it. And so, members, I don't know if we have any more questions, but it looks like it's that time. So, all right. Well, I just want to thank Representative Abler allowing me to sit in the chair seat. It was great. Hopefully the information that you guys got will really study. I think these are hot-button issues that we'll all be discussing a lot, but hopefully this information has been informative. So with that, the meeting is adjourned.